And now, from the Green 960 studios in San Francisco, this is an organic conversation with Helga Hellberg.
And welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, relationships, and life itself. I'm your host, Helga Hellberg. I hope you had a wonderful week. Thank you for all your comments and questions that you sent us. Julie from Santa Fe in New Mexico just returned from a trip to Denmark. Denmark, how funny is that? And asks, I love your show, and on a recent visit of I recently visited family in Denmark, and I realized how in Europe organic production and alternative energies seem much more connected than here in the US. Is there any attempt to add topics such as renewable energy or others to the organic claim? Well, that's a great question, Julie. Currently, the federal organic law, the National Organic Program, defines solely the food production part, how organic foods are stored, grown, shipped, and sold in the grocery store, but indeed does not address directly anything beyond that. At the same time, there are many ideas and discussions and attempts to develop an organic plus to bring in the energy piece or social justice aspects, labor rights, or environmental stewardship beyond the farm gate. You can look up marinorganic.org to see what we have done in Marin County to address these issues, from a salmon safe program that addresses watershed health far beyond the boundaries of a farm, to a school lunch and gleaning program that also works with underserved communities. There are many projects in place in Marin County and nationally that add to the organic conversation. Thank you, Julie, from Santa Fe, New Mexico. If you have feedback, a comment, or a question, please email us at share@anorganicconversation.com. Living in Northern California, this year's cherry season was extremely short. Late rains at the wrong time, just a few days before harvest, let the fruit split and made it unfit for the market. I remember a similar year last year with blackberries. There were almost none. Blackberries that this year hang overabundantly in thick, dark clusters, bursting with flavor and sweetness. Every farmer knows that after a few years of great harvests, there will be a mediocre one, followed usually by another few years of good harvests. So I wondered, why does nature go through these cycles? As I'm preparing to visit my family in Germany for a few days, I think I'm starting to understand. As I'm packing my bags, say goodbye to friends, my dog, my coworkers, and while I feel excitement about the trip and look forward to see my parents, who are getting older every year, unlike me, there's a sense of sadness about leaving in my chest. I don't mind flying. I will have a great time in Germany, and yet, already on my way to the airport, I know I will miss everything my life here holds. So actually, rather than sadness, it's a kind of bittersweet joy of truly belonging and knowing at the same time that I and every other being lives on borrowed time. I'm grateful that I'm leaving so that I remember how precious my life here is, how much I love my friends, my work, and how lucky I got when my dog adopted me a couple of years ago. I guess you got to leave sometimes to know what you're leaving. After years of abundant cherries, this was a short season. The cherries were great, but the season washed over California in only a few short weeks, and now, at best, we have the last crop from Washington at the markets before, in a week or so, by mid-August, at the latest, we will have to wait another full year before we can taste the fleshy darkness of a perfect cherry, another year before we can spit that stone again. If we pay attention to her, nature has its ways of showing us whatever we need to learn and recognize in life. The feeling of truly belonging, the joy of an abundant harvest, the acceptance of things not coming in, or things leaving much too soon, and first and foremost, not to take anything for granted. You're listening to An Organic Conversation, and we'll be right back after the break. Me in your bed, I felt it. I tried to beat you, but you're so hot that I melted. I fell right through the cracks. Now I'm trying to get back. Before the cool done run out, I'll be giving it my best. This and nothing's gonna stop me but divine intervention. I reckon it's again my turn to win some or learn some, but I won't hesitate no more, no more. It cannot wait. I'm yours. And we are back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg. I'm excited about our guests today, Karen Peter-Ross, Mia Draper, and Doug Vincent. And they all have at least one thing in common, their love for bees. So in the next hour, we'll have a very sweet conversation about honey and beekeeping. But first, as always, here's Dan McGovern with the news.
This is Sustainable Food News, your weekly news service on An Organic Conversation. I'm Dan McGovern.
The idea of a 50-year farm bill was planted in the minds of government leaders last week. Three longtime leaders of the sustainable farming industry made their way to Capitol Hill to lobby for a new agricultural system, one that sustains local ecosystems, healthy food, and rural communities. Essayist Wendell Berry was joined by Wes Jackson, a geneticist and founder of the Kansas-based Lands Institute, and Fred Kirschenman, a fellow at Iowa State University's Leopold Center and president of New York's Stone Barn Center. The trio's 50-year farm bill proposal asked to transition from annual crops to perennial ones and asked for $50 million annually to fund research to achieve that goal. Perennials are at the root of the 50-year farm bill. The plants are touted as key solutions in the fight against climate change for their extensive root system, which dramatically improves drought tolerance and prevents soil erosion, a major contributor of greenhouse gases. The three sat down with the new Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, Kathleen Merrigan, as well as members of Congress. Jackson even unloaded a couple sacks of perennial wheat flour from his nonprofit, the Land Institute, at the White House kitchen. Realizing farmers have too small a political voice, Berry said he's building an urban agrarian constituency that is devoted to farmers markets and community-supported agriculture. Some of President Obama's top cabinet members on Thursday toured a West Philadelphia supermarket to talk about efforts to bring fresh, quality foods to low-income urban areas. Philadelphia is the site of the first leg of a nationwide tour of low-income communities by the Obama administration, zeroing in on solutions for federal support of urban development. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Ron Sims said it was time to stop being able to tell what children are going to have tooth decay by zip code. The most comprehensive study to date on the mystery of disappearing honeybees, known as colony collapse disorder, said that despite numerous causes proposed over the last 2 years, it now seems clear that no single factor alone is responsible for the malady. After large-scale unexplained losses of managed U.S. honeybee colonies during winter 3 years ago, investigators set off to identify symptoms that are associated with CCD. The main symptom of CCD is simply no or a low number of adult honeybees present, but with a live queen and no dead honeybees in the hive. Often there is still honey in the hive, and immature bees, or brood, are present. Bee pollination is responsible for $15 billion in added crop value, particularly for specialty crops such as almonds and other nuts, berries, fruits, and vegetables. About one mouthful in three in the diet directly or indirectly benefits from honeybee pollination. Based on an initial analysis of collected bee samples, reports have noted that a higher number of viruses and other pathogens, pesticides, and parasites present in CCD colonies and the lower levels in non-CCD colonies. Findings to date indicate the sublethal effects of two common miticides on honeybees, as well as a combination effect of two pesticides, indicating the reality of these threats to bees and the need for further research. This is Sustainable Food News, your weekly news service on An Organic Conversation, and I'm Dan McGovern.
Thank you, Dan, of Sustainable Food News, for this incredible weekly update. Dan, CCD, Colony Collapse Disorder. Who's the author of that study?
Well, there are several authors. The report was actually mandated by the 2008 Farm Bill. So they have various federal agencies. There's 8 federal agencies involved in the report, 2 state departments of agriculture, 22 universities, and several private research efforts.
And how proven is that link that is reported? Is that, does this now trigger more research, or is this a conclusive?
No, it's not. What's conclusive is that it's just not one thing. It's not just pesticides. It's not, or a pesticide. It's not just a miticide. It's not just a virus, perhaps. But it could be a combination of things, or synergies between certain of these parasites together. So yes, definitely triggered a tremendous amount of research. In fact, that started to occur about 2 years ago. This progress report, as it's called, is the first to come out. So there's still plenty of research to be done. There's 2 large-scale, multi-year projects underway, one at the University of Georgia, which will look at the causes of CCD, and then there are others at universities around the country that are really looking into this and really lasering in on, is it pesticides, and one would check that out. Another might look at other pathogens.
And it's, of course, that has been the concern with chemicals, especially agrochemicals, for decades, that when the safety of those chemicals are tested, they are usually tested for that particular ingredient or that particular product. But we all know we are exposed to hundreds of chemicals in the environment, and there are over 100 measured in the umbilical cord of an unborn child. And so nobody really has tested the cocktail effect, the synergistic effects of these chemicals combined.
That's right.
So we'll stay on that. Thank you so much, Dan McGovern of Sustainable Food News.
Thank you, Helga.
Welcome to the show, Karen Peteros, the president of the San Francisco Beekeepers Association, and Mia Draper of Draper Farms, and Doug Vincent of BeeKind. Thanks for coming to the show. Karen, I want to start with you.
Okay.
Urban beekeeping.
Yes.
What does it take to be a beekeeper? Why bees?
Well, you've just asked me a number of questions, but what does it take to be a beekeeper is you need to have the right equipment, and you need to have bees. And beyond that, it's really a personal preference, and also based on the extent to which you have some prior experience or knowledge about what it takes to be a beekeeper.
And it's fairly new for you, right? You got into beekeeping 3, 4, 5 years ago?
Yes, actually, I am in my 4th year of beekeeping. I began beekeeping in April of 2006. So I've passed my 4th year now. And I was struck with the bee fever, as I call it.
How? Like, what happened? What was your bee moment?
My bee moment was I bought a small farm property, and it was exclusive farm use. I'm a lawyer by trade, and I was researching what exclusive farm use meant in that area under that law, and I saw honeybees. And it really triggered for me an interest, I think, that had been latent in my life previously. And I went on the internet, and I started Googling around about beekeeping, and I came across the San Francisco Beekeepers Association.
That's way too easy. So what happened? Like, you saw honeybees on the list of what of allowed methods that you can farm there, right?
And yeah, then, right.
What was the moment for you to fall in love?
Oh, to fall in love. Well, I think it was probably
with bees.
I think after I got my first hive, and I would sit there and near the entrance, and I would watch them come and go to and from the hive, and just looking at them, and they're so beautiful. And watching the different pollen colors coming in. One bee might have white pollen, another would have yellow, others would have red. Sometimes there's even purple and blue. And just watching the differences and...
On their backs, right? That's where they carry them, on their butts?
They have little hairs all over their bodies.
Yeah.
And so when they go to a flower, the pollen gets on the hairs in their body, and then they groom themselves, and they actually... pack the pollen with using their 4 front legs into little pollen baskets on their 3rd legs in the back. And then they bring them back to the hive, and that is the source of protein, minerals, and vitamins for the young bees that they are raising. So I think that is really, for me, when I fell in love, was just really watching them. I can't say the experience of opening the hive was part of falling in love with them, except to see what was going on, because I think for new beekeepers, it's, and perhaps more for women than men, I'm not sure, it's very disconcerting. I mean, who would voluntarily take up an endeavor where you expose yourself to tens of thousands of stinging insects?
And, oh, as a metaphor, I think we do it all the time.
Okay.
I hope so. But what does it take? Is it allowed? Is it legally allowed in urban areas to have a beehive? And how many can you have, like city of San Francisco?
Well, every urban area is different because you have county laws as well as town laws. In San Francisco, we're particularly fortunate because our health and safety code, in defining what are the dangerous, vicious, and poisonous animals that can be kept in the city limits, there is an express exclusion for honeybees. And so it actually is totally lawful in San Francisco, and we're additionally fortunate because it's totally unregulated. It really is a matter of whether the beekeeping activity would create a public nuisance. And then a health department will usually work with a beekeeper, sure, or work with clubs like ours to help resolve the
Let's
issue.
Keep it that way.
That's what we hope.
Yes. Karen Peteros, president of the San Francisco Beekeepers Association. Mia Draper of Draper Farms. For you, in a way, your livelihood depends on bees, not in terms of honey, but in terms of pollination. Is that an overstatement?
Well, our CSA is quite small, and so we sometimes are in wonder that some people's lives really do depend upon the vagaries of the crop.
What's the CSA?
It stands for Community Supported Agriculture. It's a nationwide movement. Most of these small farms are organic. The idea is to have a small local farm so that there is a variety of fresh produce, and of course a small field can be kept organically if it's diverse much more easily than a monocrop. And
you have an acre, right, or two? Or
that's right. And people walk and bike and bring their strollers, and so it's a way of making food locally available. And of course, we can produce things that can't be packed, tomatoes that wouldn't stack, for example, because their skins are too thin, and they're really they're wonderful.
So people as a neighborhood farm could just come by on a stroll, weigh their own vegetables, pay you money in a cash register that sits there, and it's basically a neighborhood supported. It's a neighborhood farm that you
run. Exactly. CSAs, though, are on all different models. Some people work on them, and some produce boxes and so forth. And because I work as a journalist, my husband also works, we have people just come by and pick. That works just fine for us.
So what do bees do on your farm? How many hives do you have, and why are they important?
We have, it always depends when you ask how many hives we have. At the moment, we have 10. And the bees pollinate the field. If you see, for example, a funny-looking cucumber or a lopsided apple, that would mean that you have a fruit or a vegetable that's under-pollinated. There haven't been enough visits to the flower. So it takes a lot of bees to pollinate fruits and vegetables adequately. And of course, the bees are not, although they're not native, most of the foods that we love to eat, the fruits and vegetables, are also not native. So they're symbiotic.
So what role do the bees, in your case, on a 10 hives on a 1 acre farm, how much do you keep them for pollination and how much do you keep them for honey? How much honey do 10 hives produce?
Well, right now the acre is easily pollinated by a single beehive. So we don't really need to have that many. We're working on a project, and Doug Vinson is also working on this project. We're working on breeding sustainable stock, that is to say, bees that can be kept without chemicals. One of the problems for the decline, as you heard in the news, has to do with miticides and pesticides. And so not only do we keep an organic plot, but we're also raising bees that can be kept without chemicals. So that's another crop. The bees are another crop as well as the fruits and vegetables.
Mia Draper of Draper Farms. This is an organic conversation, and in this hour we're talking about beekeeping. Doug, you are the, in a way, commercial arm, small commercial, but commercial nevertheless, of this trio here today. We heard from Dan McGovern from in the news section that one out of every three bites is directly of food that we eat is directly associated, or the result even of a bee working.
Yes.
Can you say something about that?
Yes, the honeybees. One out of every three bites that we take is directly pollinated by a honeybee. Up to 70-80% of everything in the grocery store.
Can you get a little bit closer to the mic?
Somewhere along the chain of production, a honeybee had to pollinate something.
So one out of every three bites, and then 70% indirectly.
Indirectly, things like canola oil is from the rapeseed plant, needs to be pollinated by honeybees. Alfalfa that's fed to livestock needs to be pollinated by honeybees to create alfalfa seed. Things along these lines.
So are these all bees that are commercially kept? Like, I mean, we have literally millions of acres of these crops in the U.S., especially when it comes to canola up in Canada. Who is pollinating them? These are not wild colonies. These are all commercial.
Mostly all commercial colonies.
And they are timed for the time of when these crops need to be pollinated? Like, how does it work?
It's called migratory beekeeping. Up to 90% of all the honeybees in the United States are migratory bees, that's commercial bees, and they're moved from crop to crop to do pollination. And there's a lot of money involved in the pollination industry. A lot of beekeepers do pollination for 50% of their income. The honey market is controlled by the world prices, and those fluctuate enough to the point where a lot of beekeepers are not comfortable with just producing honey.
So Mia was saying that the average is about one colony or one beehive, which has, 3,000 bees or so? Is that about average?
No.
No. Okay.
A large colony would be 50, 60, maybe 80,000 honeybees.
And so if you have a beehive with, you know, as many honeybees as you need for 1 acre, if we are talking a million of acres of crops that need to be pollinated, you need a million hives, or does that math not quite?
That's close. Depending on the crop, anywhere from 1 to 3 hives per acre to pollinate a commercial crop. Monoculture agriculture basically is large plots of land, and if you're going to plant a crop, first thing you do is what? You scrape the land clean. Now you've eliminated all the habitat for any native honeybees. You plant your crop. When the crop starts to bloom, you'll need pollination, especially for the center of the crop where there are no pollinating insects. So you have contracted with a beekeeper to come in and put X amount of beehives there per acre. Your crop blooms. 3 weeks later, the bloom's done. Now those bees are starving. The beekeeper has to move them again.
So they're right now, as we speak, there must be millions of beehives being shipped around throughout the U.S. How many beehives do we have in the United States?
I'll give you the numbers. Approximately 2 to 3 million managed colonies in the United States. 50 years ago, we had twice as many. Another number you might not know, but there's roughly 2.5 million square miles in the United States. That's one hive per square mile. In Europe and other places in the world, the number is closer to 8 to 10 hives per square mile. And in those countries, the hives aren't moved around for pollination because there's so many bees, there's so much bee forage around. The bees can live in one place, what we call stationary beekeeping. And stationary beekeeping is beneficial for the area because the bees are there year-round and they're pollinating everything through the seasons.
And we got to get into why the numbers are different in a minute. You're listening to an organic conversation today, beekeeping, with my guests, Karen Peter Ross, the president of the San Francisco Beekeepers Association, Mia Draper from Draper Farms, and Doug Vincent of Bee Kind Honey. And we'll take a break and we'll be right back.
I don't need a whole lot of don't need a big fine car. I got everything that a girl could want. I got more than I could ask for. I don't have to run around. I don't have to stay out all night. 'Cause I got a...
An Organic Conversation is brought to you by Svatica Skincare. Founded by Janet Lee Katzen, Svatica is a holistic approach to skincare that is 100% pure and natural, free of synthetic chemicals, and includes organic and wild-crafted ingredients. For more information about Svatica skincare products and the Svatica Spa, visit svatica.com. That's Svatica.com.
Hi, I'm Peter Walsh. My wife and I founded Manika Jewelry with the intention to offer a different kind of jewelry. Beautiful, made by local Bay Area artists, and without a social or environmental compromise. Our featured designers use reclaimed precious metals and Kimberly certified gemstones. It's jewelry made with heart and soul. Come visit our store just off Union Square at 11 Maiden Lane in San Francisco, or visit our website at manikajewelry.com.
For the ultimate West Marin experience, visit Toby's Feed Barn in Point Reyes Station, home of the Point Reyes Farmers Market every Saturday. Toby's Feed Barn features organic produce, native plants, gifts, books, an organic coffee bar, an art gallery, concerts, even daily yoga classes. Toby's Feed Barn in downtown Point Reyes Station, open 7 days a week, family-owned and operated since 1942, a West Marin original. For more information, visit tobysfeedbarn.com.
Fry Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites, available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FreyWine.com.
Marin Organic is an association of organic producers in Marin County, California, which has become one of the most progressive voices in the sustainable food movement in the United States. Through its many innovative initiatives, such as a school lunch and gleaning program, Marin Organic is creating a healthy, sustainable, and safe environment for all beings, today and for generations to come. Please become a partner in our work by visiting marinorganic.org and by pledging your support now. Thank you.
And we are back to An Organic Conversation. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg, and today I'm speaking with Karen Peter-Ross, the president of the San Francisco Beekeepers Association, Mia Draper of Draper Farms in San Anselmo, and Doug Vincent of Bee Kind Honey in Sebastopol. Doug, right before the break, you were talking about the stress of shipping bees around and that that might contribute to bee colony, to the collapse of colonies. What is the situation? Like, how do bees get shipped? What's the stress they are exposed to?
Okay, I'll tell you. For almond pollination in California, there is roughly 600,000-700,000 acres of almonds requiring two hives per acre. They come from all across the country. They ship them on semis covered in nets. They take usually 2 to 3 days to arrive. They're unloaded on forklifts. It's very stressful on the hives when they're buttoned up for this period of time. Often 10% of the queens get killed during transportation due to the stresses on the bees. Commercial beekeepers, they often requeen their hives multiple times per year. Once a year is common, 2 to 3 times is not unheard of. Just to replace the queens that are failing because of these stresses that are put on the bees. When the bees' very fragile immune system is stressed, the immune system fails, and the bees have all kinds of problems due to that.
So, Mia, you were saying earlier that the bee colony collapse, and specifically there's a mite problem. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What are the challenges at hand, and what do you do? What's the research that is being done to what's your work to make stronger colonies?
Well, there are two mites that are attacking the bees that have not evolved with the bees. The big problem is with the varroa mite, which is an Asian mite, which lives as a parasite on Asian bees and has worked out a relationship as a parasite with those bees. Our bees have not evolved, as I said, with that particular mite, and that mite vectors viruses. And what's happened is that we've put miticides on our hives, we being beekeepers in general, and those have escalated in strength, resulting in weakened hives from the miticides and super mites, the only mites that survive the treatment.
Because they become resistant over time, and we have used these chemicals for years and years.
Yes, yes. And so there are people who have decided to step off this treadmill, yes. Yeah. And those people have had tremendous losses. They will cite 90% loss and so forth. And what they're doing is picking. There's an American in France who has been doing this for 15 years, and he calls it the Bond 007 method. It's live and let die method. So he picks only the survivor stock. Now, Doug Vincent is doing that, and there are a number of other very small pockets of small-scale beekeepers across the United States. There are people in Georgia, in Pennsylvania, in Karen was just talking about getting some bees from Old Soul in Oregon. There are these various pockets of people who are doing this on a small scale. There's one large-scale beekeeper, Danny Weaver, who's got 5,000 bees now that have been kept for 10 years without any chemicals. But this is a movement now, and it's a grassroots movement. It's very much like what Marin Organic is doing. It's starting a seismic shift in very, very small increments on a local level.
And so for decades, or maybe hundreds of maybe thousands of years, the Asian mite has always lived with the Asian honeybee, and now that we have European bees, they can't deal with the Asian mite, right?
Yeah,
and the only way to get out of that cycle is to stop cold turkey, basically, to get him out. 90% might die, 80% might die, and the survivors hopefully will be strong enough to, as a European bee, to then be resistant to, or can live in harmony with that mite. Is that the idea?
That's our opinion. The other way is to continually treat with more and more strong miticides. And one of the things as beekeepers that we've been complaining about is that pesticides are treated on adult bees and not on larvae. And we want to know what are the effects. And so the USDA has just come out with the figures, and the chemicals that are found in the larvae are 100% miticides that are put in the hives by the beekeepers. And so it's an embarrassing revelation.
Yes. And it seems like you're on the pulse of the time, of course. The state of Florida announced a couple of weeks ago that any honey produced or sold there, even if it's shipped in, cannot contain any contaminants, including no miticides. So Florida as a state from now on, according to that news, you can only sell honey that was produced in a hive that was not treated in any way. So your research seems to be exactly what is needed the most. Karen, how many hives do you have?
I currently have about 35 hives. I have about 10 in San Francisco and 25 up in Southern Oregon. I don't treat any of my bees, and I think Mia is correct that there really is a grassroots movement among the smaller scale and stationary beekeepers to not get on that treadmill. I certainly see that for urban beekeepers.
So you have 10 hives here, and you have how many, 20? 25?
About 25.
In Oregon?
Yes.
Don't you miss them?
Yes and no.
I mean, how often do they get to see you?
Oh, once a month.
And then what do they do? The other, you know, how do you make sure that they don't?
They do their bee thing. That's one of the great things about beekeeping is that you can actually do.
What's the bee thing?
The bee thing is they're out foraging on flowers, collecting nectar, collecting pollen. Yeah, doing their bee thing. But that is one of the joys of beekeeping is that it can be as little or as much work as you want. You don't need a lot of space. In an urban environment, you have to be a bit more diligent than you would, say, if you had bees on a farm like Mia has, and I have up in Southern Oregon, and Doug has some outyards up in his area. But, just let the bees do their thing. They know best what to do.
And you go up once a month to feed them or move them, or what's the...
No, I just go up once a month because I like being up there.
But doing the bee thing, I mean, what's the... Why is there more pressure in the city, in urban areas? Because there's less food to be found for them?
Actually, in an urban environment, it is easier and better for bees. And that is because there, especially in San Francisco, where we have blooms in the Bay Area, we have blooms 10 months out of the year.
Something is always in bloom.
Something is always in bloom. Up in Southern Oregon, like in Northern California, the dry season, the blooming dries up. And the bees really don't have anything to forage on. So beekeeping in urban areas actually it can be healthier and better for the bees and more successful for the beekeeper than in other areas.
So 25 hives up there, 10 here. What's your relationship with them? Like, do you know every colony as in, like, do they have a character for you? What's your...
Yeah, I think honeybees, a colony, honeybees are individuals, but they're more of a distinct organism in and of themselves because they all work collectively and cooperatively for the success of the colony. I paint every one of my hives a totally different color. So I've got green hive, blue hive, purple hive, bright orange, and that's the way that I can associate their personalities. And I kind of keep track of them through color. I tend to be a visual person. But yes, I have some colonies. In fact, Doug and me and I were talking before the show about having what we call hot hives, a colony that tends to be defensive. Honeybees generally are very gentle by nature unless they're disturbed or threatened. But some honeybee colonies tend to be a bit more defensive than others. And so as beekeepers, we tend to call them hot hives. So I've got a number of hot hives, but...
Yeah, the rowdy ones.
They don't want to be bothered.
No,
and
totally understand.
And some are more productive in terms of honey than others. Some colonies, I've got one colony in San Francisco now that has no pollen stores, but yet another, it's jam-packed with pollen. So there are different personalities. Some colonies produce a lot of propolis, otherwise known as bee glue. It's a resin that they collect from trees and woody shrubbery. And it has antibacterial qualities, and it's part of their whole immune strategy to fight off pests and disease. Some of my colonies produce tons of propolis, and it's a total chore to get any frame out of the hive. Others produce none. So they all do have different personalities. Some fly at lower temperatures. Usually it's around 55 degrees where a colony will start to fly. I've got some that fly in the high 40s. So they all do have different personalities, sort of like a dog or a cat.
So when you paint that beehive, do they have a color preference? I mean, bees must recognize color, or do they go by scent only when they find?
Bees associate their home by location. They also do see color. They see an ultraviolet light. Location, the only color location. They don't see is red, which they see as black. So they do. They see the greens, the yellows, the peaches, the oranges, the blues, the purples, the aquas. So I've
and
got...
Yes, you brought up that real estate, location, location, location. Doug, is it true when you have a beehive situated and the swarm goes out and they find back to their hive, if you moved that hive 30 feet, they would not find it? It has to be moved at least a mile or two. How do you do it?
Well, traditionally, the saying is you can move the hive 2 feet or 2 miles, anything in between, and they'll get lost. When they fly out, they have oriented to their home spot, and they can navigate down to within a few inches.
How?
Through visual cues and landmarks. And when they fly out and they gather their pollen and nectar, they'll come back. And if you've moved the hive 2 feet, they can still find it. But if it's 10 feet away, they won't find it. It may take a while. Some bees may find it, but they'll get lost usually. Their range is 2 to 3 miles, their effective range. And so they know all the landmarks in that area. If you get past that, you take the hive and move it 2 miles away. When they come out, they know they've moved, and they'll reorient to that spot. And their memory is generally 7 to 14 days. So after a couple of weeks, if you move them back to their near their original location, they'll reorient to that spot. Sometimes if you put you can move the hive like 20 feet away and just put a bush or a branch on the front of the hive. When the bees come out, they'll have to go through that bush and they'll know something's different and they'll reorient to that spot. A few of the foragers may go back to the original location, but that's a way you can move the hive a short distance.
Resetting the GPS. That's
exactly.
Quite amazing.
Exactly.
And I had the pleasure to witness a bee dance where the bee came back and then did the zigzag movement up and down. And that is the way how a few bees that go out and come back tell the others where to go and what to find where and how to find back, right? Is that correct?
Yes, there are several bee dances. The two most popular, widely known dances, there's the circle dance and there's the waggle dance. There's also a vibration dance and there's a humming kind of dance that tell different information. But the waggle dance tells direction and distance to the nectar or water source, pollen source. They come back and they give the nurse bees or the house bees a sample of what they found, and then they do this little dance, and it's on the face of the comb, and it tells them which direction to go and about how far to go. And when they get to that area, they start hunting by smell.
That's the waggle dance.
Yes.
And what's the circle dance?
The circle dance is for anything that's very close to the hive. They don't have a direction and distance. They just know something's close, say within 50 to 100 feet. And they just come in and they do this race in a circle, and they turn around and race the other direction. And that sends foragers out looking very close to the hive for whatever it is the forager has brought in, be it pollen, nectar, water, or whatever.
How in the world did we find out that it's the waggle dance and the circle dance and what they do?
It was 100 years ago. It was 150 years ago they discovered this. And through observation hives with glass-walled hives, and people have been so fascinated by the honeybees ever since. I mean, from before that time till today, and we still don't understand everything that's going on, although we like to think we do.
Yeah, we do like to think we do.
Yeah.
Mia Draper of Draper Farms in San Anselmo. Karen mentioned earlier there are different jobs that certain bees do to support the entire colony. What are some of those tasks? Do you know from your experience that it's always the same bees that go out? I guess you don't move your hives at all, right? On an acre, it wouldn't be enough space to move them somewhere else.
Well, the bees evolve through a number of different roles. They're born into roles as house bees, and they move through being nurse bees and undertaker bees and cleaning bees to being guard bees. And then at that point, they undergo a physiological change. Up until that point, they actually don't age in human terms anyway. There's no oxidation of their brains. And so when they take an orientation flight, then they start to go out as foragers. So a single bee would move through all of those roles. But what's really interesting is that the colony is a superorganism. It functions as though it's one body. It would be a little bit like if you were watching television and sent your hand out to the refrigerator to get yourself a ham sandwich. So the bees function as one unit. And so let's just say there's much more brood than the nurses are able to take care of or able to feed royal jelly. And you have got a lot of foragers. So some foragers will revert back to being nurses. And what's fascinating about it is that they will actually reverse age, which is the only creatures on Earth have been observed to do this, the oxidation in the brain will be reversed. And researchers now are looking at this for information on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease.
That is amazing. We'll be diving. I can see everyone here in the studio nodding. We'll talk about the super organism in a beehive, or that bees are. In a second, we'll take a quick break. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg. We'll be right back.
Organic Conversation is brought to you by Svatica Skincare. Founded by Janet Lee Katzen, Svatica is a holistic approach to skincare that is 100% pure and natural, free of synthetic chemicals, and includes organic and wild-crafted ingredients. For more information about Svatica Skincare products and the Svatica Spa, visit svatica.com. That's S-P-H-A-T-I-K-A.com.
Marin Organic is an association of organic producers in Marin County, California, which has become one of the most progressive voices in the sustainable food movement in the United States. Through its many innovative initiatives, such as a school lunch and gleaning program, Marin Organic is creating a healthy, sustainable, and safe environment for all beings, today and for generations to come. Please become a partner in our work by visiting marinorganic.org and by pledging your support now. Thank you.
Frey Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frey never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Frey organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Frey Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites, available at grocery stores and online at freywine.com. That's FreyWine.com.
Are you looking for a romantic and unusual location in the Bay Area for your wedding or upcoming anniversary? Toby's Feed Barn offers the perfect venue for your celebration. A rustic barn in the heart of beautiful West Marin, with local organic caterers ready to delight your guests amid bales of hay. Toby's Feed Barn in downtown Point Reyes Station. Open 7 days a week. Family owned and operated since 1942. A West Marin original. For more information, visit tobysfeedbarn.com.
Sustainable Food News is the premier source of daily news and market information for the organic, sustainable, and natural food industries. Headline after headline, Sustainable Food News reports on a profound shift in food buying habits as more and more people begin to understand the impact of their purchases on the environment and communities around the world. Join Dan McGovern, publisher of Sustainable Food News, every Saturday morning on An Organic Conversation. For more information, visit www.sustainablefoodnews.com.
And we are back to An Organic Conversation here on Green 960. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg. We are talking about beekeeping today. With Mia Draper from Draper Farms, Karen Peter Ross from the San Francisco Beekeepers Association. She's the president, and Doug Vincent of Bee Kind Honey. So we just left into the break talking about this superorganism, and everyone started nodding. How does it work, Karen? Tell me one more time. What? So they are drones.
So
the job of the drones is just to mate.
Okay, so in within a colony, you will find, we'll call it three types of bees to be simplistic. We'll find the queen, which is the only reproductive female. And we'll find the workers, which we'll call non-reproductive females. They do not lay eggs, except in aberrant situations. And then we have the drones, which are the males. The sole role of the drones, like the queen, is reproduction. And their sole job is to go out and find virgin queens and to mate with them.
So they don't work, they don't collect pollen, they just have sex.
That's right. And then they die.
Wow.
And it's the workers, the females, that do all the work within the colony. And then the queen lays the eggs and reproduces all of the individuals, which really pretty much, except for her, only live for about 6 to 8 weeks during spring to fall.
And then, Doug, you were saying the beehive can adjust to circumstances.
Yes. When there's a shortage of pollen available, when less and less pollen is coming into the hive, the foragers, they will recruit more pollen foragers, and they will restrict the queen's egg laying, so she will lay fewer and fewer eggs. And when there's lots more pollen available, they feed the queen lots of royal jelly, and she lays a bazillion eggs. When there's an abundance is when they grow their colony, and that's when they get crowded and they swarm and they divide the colony at the superorganism level. The whole colony splits, and that's how they reproduce.
Where's that, and who steers that? It's the female bees.
The workers. When the workers feel crowded, they will start making new queen cells, and they'll stop feeding the old queen. And after about a week or so, the old queen is small enough to the point where she can actually fly well. And just before one of the new queens hatch out, half the girls load up with honey and they shove the old queen out the door. And there's a swarm.
So do the worker bees decide how many queen bees will be born? Or who decides that? How does the queen come in place?
They'll raise anywhere from a few to a couple of dozen queen cells before they swarm. And usually the first queen out that hatches will kill the other queen cells. If multiple queens hatch at the same time, they may fight. Often what happens is the queen that hatches will pipe. She'll make a little piping noise. And the queens that are still in the cells will toot in response, and then she'll go kill them. It's quite brutal, but it's the way nature.
Why would they answer if they know they get killed?
I don't think they probably don't know. I don't know.
But it would be the logical. I mean, there can't be 10 queens because then
right.
the hive would split eventually, and there are not enough worker bees to support the growing of a new colony. Is that correct?
They'll usually just accept one queen. Occasionally, there's a mother and daughter in the hive at the same time, and as the old queen is failing, the daughter queen takes over. But that's in a supersedure situation where the old queen is failing and they've raised a new queen because they knew something was wrong with the old queen. A lot has to do with the pheromones in the hive. Most of the hive decisions are based on the pheromones and the smells within the hive. The queen's pheromones get less and less with age. Worker bees live, 5-6 weeks in summer? But the queen can live 5 years, has been documented. But generally, 2 to 3 years for a queen.
But that's the perfect democracy, right? I mean, males have... Well, I don't want to say that.
Pretty
leave
much.
The male part out. I don't think necessarily that's the role we should take. But it is completely regulated by the female worker bees. What's happening? Who's being
yes.
developed? How many?
The queen,
when we need new leadership?
Yes, the worker bees. It's a communal decision. The perfect democracy. The queen's basically, she lends her pheromones to the hive to keep everyone working together, and she's an egg-laying machine.
Well, I do think that a perfect democracy should include some males and not just having them over there. But actually, that mating ritual is quite interesting. They meet in midair, right?
Yes, yes.
How does that work, Karen?
Well, interestingly, there are areas that are defined by geographics and persist for years and years and years where drones will congregate. They're called drone congregation areas. So drones will fly out from hives from all around the area, and they'll just kind of fly around and hang out waiting for a virgin queen who will also go to that area.
In midair somewhere.
Yes, like 100 feet up. And so the drones have very large eyes to see better, and they also will be attracted to the virgin queens by her scent. And so they chase the virgin queen, and the lucky drone will be able to mate with her. And immediately after the mating act, he falls away and dies. Essentially, his reproductive organs is sort of ripped out of his body, and he falls to the ground and will die.
Oh, he doesn't even make it down there. That's it.
Probably not. But what's very interesting is that the queen bee will mate with many different drones during individual mating flights and during the second week of her life. And as beekeepers, we want our virgin queens to mate with as many drones as possible, best around 20. And so the purpose for that is a genetic diversity within the colony itself.
Sure.
So she may mate with drones who comes from a colony that are great honey producers. She may mate with a drone that is from a survivor colony that has never been treated with miticides or chemicals that are able to deal with mites.
And you cannot affect that in any way, right? That is out of your range. You can feed a queen bee to become a queen and split the hive, but the mating between drones and queens happens in midair, and you can't.
You actually can try. You can try to control that, and that's if you have the appropriate land and you can have isolated mating yards where you will then surround your breeder queen or your mating colonies with colonies that you're wanting to produce the drones from to mate. There is artificial insemination of queens. There's a whole industry in that where you can actually buy a queen that has been artificially inseminated with the sperm of drones of a certain line. So you can, but most of us as small scale stationary beekeepers, we don't have the land resources, nor can we flood an area with certain types of drones. So it's not in our control.
Mia, you were saying in the beginning that honey has a very special status in society and had for hundreds and maybe thousands of years, including meat. What do you do? What do you do with your honey? And what is that component that makes you giggle right now? Why is it such a sacred food for you?
Why is honey a sacred food? Well, for us, of course, it's anything that you're very close to that you grow or harvest is always has a specialness to it. But honey has been a sacrifice for millennia, probably the most widespread sacrifice. And there are many, many religious practices. Certainly, Rosh Hashanah for the Jews involves honey and apple. And a Hindu wedding, a modern Hindu wedding, a modern Mayan wedding, all involve honey rituals. Those are all traditions that have persisted for a very long time.
I'm realizing that in the complex world of bees, an hour, of course, is not even scratching the surface. So I will have you guys back. And Doug, you brought some honey from your company, Be Kind Honey, which all that information, of course, is on our website, how to order it, where to find it. And we'll get into a little honey feast here in a minute. Thank you, Karen Peter Ross, the president of the San Francisco Beekeepers Association, Mia Draper of Draper Farms, and Doug Vincent of Be Kind Honey in Sebastopol for coming to the studio. Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
You're welcome.
Diving into the world of bees. An Organic Conversation is produced by our famous Heidi Hartley, sound engineering by the incredible Jen Lloyd. Outstanding production assistant is Kristen O'Heary. Underwriting production provided by the amazing one and only Mark Van Gelder. Thank you all, and also always thanks to the team here at Green 960, the Fab Four, Corey Kellerwood, Mark McNown, John Scott, and John Plessis. And of course, thank you, our listeners, for being part of this show and for actually listening. Tune in next week. We'll be celebrating 40 years of community leadership of a retail store in Marin County. For blogs, podcasts, and more information on this show and previous shows, please visit our website at anorganicconversation.com. You can also find us now on iTunes, where you can download An Organic Conversation to your iPhone or iPod and take us with you wherever you go. We love to hear from you. Please send us your comments and questions to share@anorganicconversation.com. Coming up next is the Gavin Newsom Show, so please stay put. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg. Have a great weekend. And again, thanks for listening to An Organic Conversation here on Green 960. And some folks say this bear's the best I ever had. And some folks got a bear beneath their feet. Some folks drive the bears out.